Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's February 4th. Currently, we've got 41 degrees here in Old Town Park City under cloudy skies. Heber City reporting 44 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yes, it is a mild and windy morning out there for most areas, as those temperatures are well above where they should be for this time of the year. In fact, our temperatures are above what our average daytime high temperatures should be for this time of the year. So we will continue to warm up in Park City. I expect high temperatures to reach near the 50-degree mark as we go throughout the afternoon. In the Heber Valley, we're likely climbing into the mid to upper 50s this afternoon. We'll have lots of cloud cover, a few peaks of sunshine here or there, but expect more clouds than sunshine as we go throughout the day. Now, as we go into tonight, we'll start to introduce a little moisture out there across the area, so we could have a few isolated rain showers developing in parts of the area as we get towards overnight tonight, but they'll be isolated in nature, but a better chance of rain showers developing across the Heber Valley as we go into your Wednesday. It won't rain all day, but by Wednesday afternoon, a pretty good chance of seeing some of those scattered rain showers across the area, with temperatures climbing into the lower 50s in the Heber Valley. Now, Park City will have some of those rain and snow showers mixing together, but it will still be a mild afternoon with high temperatures, even in Park City, despite the clouds and the wintry precipitation climbing into the mid-40s. Now, we're not expecting a ton of accumulation around Park City, but as you get up into some of the mountain resorts, we could see a couple inches of snow add up there. Now, as we go into your forecast for your Thursday, we'll have a few isolated flurries and snow showers around Park City. As we go throughout the day, cooler weather will settle in, so highs will be back into the lower 40s, with overnight lows starting off into the 20s on your Thursday morning. And in the Heber Valley, we're looking at mostly cloudy skies, temperatures starting off into the 20s, highs into the mid-40s. Now, heading into Friday, we've got a stronger storm system moving our way. That will bring a rain-snow mix to the Heber Valley on your Friday. Temperatures will start off probably around 40 and drop into the 30s during the afternoon hours. And again, we'll be expecting that rain changing over to snow in the Heber Valley. And Park City will likely be looking at a mainly snow event. And this one could add up to a couple of inches of snow there, even for Park City, and especially for the mountains surrounding the area there, with high temperatures likely holding into the 30s as we go throughout your Friday. So some big changes on the way after dealing with some spring-like conditions today. We'll likely start to see things going downhill closer to winter-like conditions heading into the end of the work week. And then by the time we get towards the weekend, get ready for winter's chill to return, as temperatures will be in the teens for high or lows, and highs only in the 20s around Park City, and low highs only around freezing in the Heber Valley. And by the time we get towards Sunday morning, we're likely going to be tracking single-digit temperatures returning back to both Park City and the Heber Valley, with high temperatures struggling to get back near freezing. So, Leslie, the changes are on the way, but they're starting off spring-like today.
Oh, man, right? And we're just losing snow quick. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And on the phone with us now, with a look in the backcountry, we've got Nikki from the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning.
Good morning. So we are sad to report that on February 3rd, a 37-year-old man from Evanston died in an avalanche while snowmobiling in the Monte Cristo area. So this is outside the Ogden Area Mountains. The victim's friend called for help, being unable to locate him, prompting a multi-agency search that eventually found him buried. Our condolences go out to friends, the family, and the entire community affected by this tragedy. There will be staff from the UAC visiting the site today to hopefully get more information. So there'll be more on that as more information continues to come out. Otherwise, yesterday was a generally quiet day in the backcountry. Only a few avalanches reported, and ski resorts saw widespread wind activity and some wet loose activity at lower elevations. Today we've got the same three issues as yesterday. The winds have remained really strong, just as high at those mid elevations as they were at the upper elevations, gusting into the 80s and 90s at times. That's been forming strong, hard slabs of wind drifted snow on all aspects. Those slabs rest on top of weak faceted snow in many areas and have not bonded well. As well, pay attention to the cornices along ridge lines, especially the Park City ridge line. They should not be underestimated. Multiple cornice triggered avalanches have been reported in the last few days. All of these weak layers are sitting on top of one of the persistent weak layers. So the upper layer formed during last week's cold, clear weather. As well, there's still that lower layer of facets near the ground that formed in December. This layer is most likely to be triggered on steep, thin snowpack areas or repeater slopes. A good idea is to check out the avalanche page and see what's previously avalanched. And then finally, with these above average temperatures today, watch for wet, loose avalanches at mid and lower elevations. The elevated winds did seem to keep the snow at bay, but pay attention to warning signs that could include rollerballs, pinwheels, and a surface that's no longer supportable. As well in neighborhoods, just pay attention to roof avalanches, making sure that you're not like below a steep roof as the snow surface becomes saturated.
Okay, Nikki, appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Destin Graybaugh with a preview of this week's county council meeting. We've got our weekly Utah legislative report. Today we'll be talking with KUAIR reporter Sean Higgins and finally the director of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, discussing some open space issues. At last, the Treasure Hill conservation easement scheduled for final approval at this week's Park City Council meeting. While developer Dakota Pacific has created a website, Wasatch Back Future, to oppose a referendum effort by another group, Protect Summit County. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports on the battle over the 50 acres around Skullcandy's headquarters at Kimball Junction.
Dakota Pacific Real Estate has emailed Summit County voters through a group called Wasatch Back Future, urging them not to sign a referendum petition related to their Kimball Junction development. The referendum seeks to block the Summit County Council's controversial December 2024 approval of a 725-unit neighborhood near Skullcandy. The development deal also includes a public-private partnership to build more housing and community amenities near where the Kimball Junction Library is. Seven Summit County residents are sponsoring the referendum. It calls for a countywide vote on the county's development agreement with Dakota Pacific. Wasatch Back Future's website initially didn't say Dakota Pacific set up the group. Now it does, and CEO Mark Stanworth says the intent was never to disassociate, which is why we intentionally used DPRE officials as the initiating parties for the required disclosures rather than unrelated supporters. The group has registered with the state government as a political issues committee, which allows them to raise funds to fight the referendum, including dissuading voters from signing the petition. Stanworth says Dakota Pacific opposes the petition because it thinks, quote, the agreement reached with the council after thousands of collective hours of careful deliberation is the best possible outcome for the community. Council members cited state legislative pressure when they approved the development in December. The company's opposition to the referendum comes after it filed to incorporate the residential portion as a town January 8th, 2 weeks after the referendum petition was filed. Dakota Pacific's allowed to make the area a town because of a law Utah passed in 2024. The law allows developers to decide their own zoning with a self-appointed board. The Utah Lieutenant Governor's Office is assessing whether Dakota Pacific's town is feasible, whether it can raise enough taxes to balance a budget. If it's deemed feasible and unless that law is changed or struck down, residents' referendum can't stop the 725-unit neighborhood. KPCW's unaware of any court cases challenging the law. What the referendum could affect is the other half of the development agreement, namely the public-private partnership. Under the agreement's severability clause, even if part of the development plans fall through, the rest can still be built. Dakota Pacific's proposed incorporation does not include the land where the partnership would happen, Skullcandy's parcel and the Sheldon Richens Building area. That's where the county and developer hope to build a 1,000-spot parking garage with a mixed-use plaza, 165 affordable housing units, and a pedestrian bridge across 224 on top of it. The Kimball Junction Transit Center would expand and a new library would go next to Skullcandy. Those amenities are on the chopping block even if Dakota Pacific can incorporate a town. The other half of the development agreement may still be enforceable, so voters could reject it. But according to Summit County Manager Shane Scott, the agreement is not yet in effect. Dakota Pacific has not signed it, which the referendum sponsors say is evidence they don't want to commit to some of the benefits they promised. Whether Dakota Pacific signs the agreement may not be relevant, Stanworth tells KPCW, if the sponsors overturn the council's side of the agreement. The development agreement allows Dakota Pacific to terminate it anyway if, quote, the referendum or challenge is submitted to a vote of the people. Referendum sponsors need just over 4,500 signatures before March 3rd for the issue to appear on the November 4th ballot. Dakota Pacific has repeatedly told KPCW it's committed to delivering on the development and partnership as laid out in the agreement the council approved in December. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow, starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have County Manager Destin Graybaugh. Good morning, Destin.
Good morning, Leslie.
First up, a discussion on property acquisition by the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. Why is the county involved? Does the county own the property?
No, actually, state law requires that the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources present to any county in which they're purchasing property, there's an in-holding, so a piece of private property wholly contained within the current Creek Wildlife Management Area that they have under contract right now. So they're providing an update and asking the council to provide a letter of support, though I don't believe that's strictly required for them to proceed.
All right, but this, so it's a privately owned parcel that...
That they have under contract, that's my understanding.
Got it. All right, the council will be getting an update about the 2018 $10 million open space bond amount. So how much do we have left?
So part of the discussion is that there are portions of the funds that are spent, portions of the funds that are allocated, and other portions of the funds that are unallocated. The county issued $5 million of debt just a few years ago, and we have spent close to $3 million of that, but we've allocated additional $4 million of it, and there is a public hearing tonight, which I'm sure we'll get to, that would allocate some additional portions of those. So we're talking about those things. The nice thing is we haven't actually issued the second half of $10 million, the other five, because those funds are only allocated and not yet actually needed to be in hand.
Okay, so in that allocation, is there still money for the Lundin property? And maybe give us an update on the status of that.
Yeah, so we have two projects that we've allocated $2 million each to. So that includes the Lundin property and the Laryngirch property. Both of those, the county council has expressed support, and we've allocated those portions of funds. But I believe they're still working through details of the conservation easements, working with some of the private and public parties that are not the county while they work through some of those things. That includes the Lundins. I think that there is still an effort from Midway to make sure that is able to happen. The county's funding isn't contingent on any particular timeline. And so what we're hoping is that they can come back with kind of a renewed proposal, a renewed deal among the private property owners that own that property so that we can get that conservation easement put in place.
Okay, so you sound pretty optimistic that will happen.
Yeah, I think it's a good example of, you know, a lot of the people involved all want it to happen. It's kind of just figuring out the details of how to make it a reality.
Yeah. There's a report in the packet that shows bonding for open space is a good deal. It looks like you would get 6 times the amount of value that you would get just buying it on the open market.
Yeah, I think that there are many benefits to the method that the county is doing. So what we have done is we have leveraged our funds so that there are private and other public investments from entities like the NRCS, which is the National Resource Conservation Service. Typically, the county contributes somewhere in the range of about a fifth of the total cost of a conservation easement. So while, yes, there are large numbers that we're talking about, really, we're leveraging these funds and utilizing other funding sources to be able to make them happen.
Okay. Anything in your manager's report that you can tell us? I didn't see anything.
No, I don't think I have anything for this week.
Okay. And as you mentioned, two public hearings, both for open space. Tell us about the first one. This is for the Pear Tree Llama Farm property.
Yeah, so this is a property out by Midway. It's kind of on the southeast side of Midway. It's a beautiful property, and I think it seems like both of these projects actually are very straightforward. There's, you know, not many private property owners, and we think we have a pretty clear path forward to getting these projects conserved in the near future.
So this first one, we're talking about 40 acres, and then the county's contribution would be $750,000?
Correct.
So why this parcel in particular?
So just like every other project, what we're doing is we look for willing landowners. So none of this money is used to forcibly purchase conservation easements. When there is a property owner who owns agricultural property and wants to preserve it, we just have funding available to help them do that. So in this case, this property owner approached us and provided a notice of intent. That's the NOIs that they fill out with our Wasatch Open Lands Board. And they go through the process. So they've already had a public hearing at the Open Lands Board. Open Lands Board made a positive recommendation to the county council, who ultimately will make the decision tomorrow night on supporting this project with funds, which I fully expect them to do.
Okay, and then that second parcel, we're talking about funding up to $1 million for the Holmes Family Dairy Farm. This is 52 acres. Where's this, and why does that make sense to support?
So there are pieces of property out on the East Valley, I believe, outside of east of Heber City. And this is one of the few remaining functioning dairies in the county. I think it's dairy was a very big part of this county's past. And I think everyone's really excited to be able to preserve this. You know, it's a great case of local people who have been here for a long time being willing to step up and do things that benefit the whole community. So by preserving this property, I think we get to preserve our rural character, and particularly the operation of a dairy that otherwise we might lose to development.
Okay, finally wanted to ask you, an employee of the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office has asked the county council to investigate allegations that the undersheriff retaliated against him and interfered in investigations. What can you tell me about it?
You know, anytime we get complaints like this, it's a very serious matter and something that we always look to following every applicable law and policy. This is going to be no exception. We're going to follow that process, but ultimately we'll work through those details as we normally do.
Yeah,
in a very careful manner.
Why is it being brought to the county council? I mean, the sheriff's office is an independent office, no?
The sheriff is independently elected.
Right. So why does it come to the county council? Because he's not getting any resolution with the sheriff, or?
You know, we're still working through the procedural details of how this will work. I think ultimately these matters tend to be handled, privately, so that we can respect the privacy of the individuals involved. And I think that's something that we are going to take very seriously here to make sure that we do an appropriate analysis of what steps need to be taken and whether or not the council needs to be involved. And ultimately, we'll render whatever decisions are appropriate given the matter.
Okay, so is the county attorney involved at this point?
Our attorneys are involved anytime we take, we get notices from attorneys or we deal with legal matters. And that's not an exception, you know, in this case.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Not this morning.
Okay. Dustin, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, Heber City Manager Matt Brower says that parking is one of the main limitations facing downtown at today's meeting. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports council members will work on plans to add more parking spaces.
The lack of parking is a problem for downtown businesses and eventgoers. To address the issue, the city plans to buy property for future parking and require developers to help create more spots for cars. Among the changes that could be coming to Heber is the creation of a parking district covering the downtown core.
The businesses, the property owners in that district could partner with the district to bring about the parking, so they're not individually responsible for providing their own parking. They could use the district's parking to meet their parking needs. So trying to create efficiencies where there are none right now.
Brower says business owners have been generally supportive of the plan. Currently, they're required to provide a certain number of spaces based on their square footage, but it's proven difficult for many to comply. He says the city will start with surface parking. In time, it could construct a parking garage if the demand is high. Another future change could be paid parking, but Brower says that's likely a few years away.
You got to have sufficient parking before you can actually begin a metering for the parking. So our goal right now is to provide that parking space.
Heber will likely start with angled street parking. At the city council meeting Tuesday, it will also buy the old Heber Light and Power building just west of City Hall for $876,000. In future, Brower says the site will be cleared for a parking lot. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
We're into week three of the Utah State Legislature, and on the phone with an update on a handful of bills out of the hundreds being reviewed, I have KUER reporter Sean Higgins. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with House Bill 355. This is the Critical Infrastructure Materials Amendments, which would, as I understand, make it easier for gravel pits to expand to property already owned while limiting a local government's ability to deny the expansion. I think this really has to do with what, the quarry in Parley's Canyon?
That one really seems so. That's been the one rock quarry that's been in the news lately. This is a bill from Representative Casey Snyder. He's a member of leadership right now. Looking at the status of the bill, it was just released end of last week, and it's now in the House Rules Committee. So what that means for people who are unfamiliar with the process, that means that a bill is waiting to be scheduled for a committee hearing. So also, I believe Representative Snyder sits on the Rules Committee, so I would assume that this one will get a committee hearing eventually. It just depends on what other priorities the House has at the moment. So once we get a committee hearing on that, we'll have a little bit more news. But as of right now, it looks to be making some changes to construction material use, a number of other technical things. But I think definitely for people who have been following the quarry saga in Parley's Canyon, will be following this one closely.
Yeah, a lot of work has been done by the organization Heal Utah to limit the amount of work that can be done there in the canyon, just because they say it's not safe for residents. And it sounds like this bill would basically take away local control, because it was a decision made by Salt Lake County, and severely limit the power of local government to make decisions to protect the health and safety of their communities, which is what we have government for, right? Public safety. So how does this square? I mean, how is it that all of the work done to get something approved can just be wiped away with, you know, a governor signing a bill?
Well, I think one thing you definitely, it's just certainly a theme for people who have watched the legislature over the last few years. They're all about local control under some circumstances, and very much not for it in certain other circumstances. And I think we've seen it for housing policy, certainly over the last couple of years. Summit County residents know this well on some of the HTRZ talk, those housing and transit reinvestment zones. There are certain things the state is not shy about stepping in and mandating when it comes to things they want to get done as far as infrastructure, maybe some energy development, things like that. And yes, there are certain parts in state code where certainly municipalities and counties have ultimate authority over land use. This may be something where the state wants to step in a little bit more. And I know we're going to talk about some housing bills, but there are some housing bills that maybe do that same thing.
Yeah. Well, let's just jump to those housing bills. We've got House Bill 37, the Utah Housing Amendments, which basically introduces a density overlay in all housing zones across the state. And I think there was one other, but
They use a term called specified municipality, which mm-hmm. might sound a little scary to some people in Summit County when we're thinking about Dakota Pacific, especially when there were some bills in the past that were written specifically to deal with that parcel in particular. But looking at this one, it's very long and technical. But basically, like you said, Leslie, it's aimed at making affordable housing easier to build from a zoning perspective in cities and towns across the state. I looked up the definition of that specified municipality this morning. It's actually quite broad. So as far as the bill goes, this is directly from the bill. Specified municipality means a city of the first, second, third, or fourth class, or a city of the fifth class with a population of 5,000 or more if the city is located within a county of the first, second, or third class. Basically, what that city of the first class, county of the first class means, that's just a population number. I believe the only county of the first class in the state is Salt Lake County. It's the biggest county in the state. It has over a million people in it. But adding those other lower classes, that's almost the entire state, except for the most rural areas, I would believe, that would fall under the provisions of this bill. So it's not singling out a county like Summit County or a town like Park City to mandate these types of things. It's really trying to encourage more affordable housing construction and making it a little bit easier for these planning commissions, for these city councils, these county councils to approve it with a little less heartburn than in the past.
Okay, and I know at this point Summit County Council is kind of monitoring that. They haven't really taken an opinion on it, I guess, still waiting to see what it really means. House Bill 249, these are nuclear power amendments and would basically set the groundwork for nuclear energy production in Utah, something I know that two of our Wasatch-backed lawmakers support.
Yeah, this one has been really interesting. I was at the committee hearing for this bill last week, and all of the rhetoric from state leaders kind of up and down the leadership ranks on the Republican side say Utah needs to be a nuclear power hub for at least the Western United States in the future. And this bill really creates the framework for that to happen. So the regulatory framework that would need to be in place for future nuclear power to come online in the state of Utah. Something Representative Carl Albrecht said last week, he's the sponsor of this bill in the House. He said, if he's being honest, we're maybe a decade or more away from these efforts coming to fruition. So it's not like we're going to be building nuclear reactors later this year to be coming online in 2026. This is a long process. This is an unproven technology, largely in the United States. Obviously, people have some really strong memories of disasters like Fukushima in Japan in 2011, Three Mile Island in Chernobyl in the 80s and 70s in Ukraine and the United States. So there's a lot of baggage for a lot of people when it comes to nuclear power. Obviously, the storage of nuclear waste is something people in the West are hyper-focused with. Well-documented health risks associated with that there. And what we hear people who are really strong supporters of investing in this technology is we've come a long way since these areas, since these disasters back in the first, second generation of nuclear power. Obviously, Fukushima, that was a little bit of a natural disaster with a tsunami that ended up coming in and causing that disaster in Japan. But there's a proof of concept project in Kemmerer, Wyoming that is looking at smaller scale nuclear reactors that could maybe come to Utah and bring some of this power. And honestly, a lot of state lawmakers are really worried about the power demands of AI data centers. When we look at the raw numbers, the amount of gigawatts required to fully power all the expected data centers that are coming online in the next few years, it's exponentially more than what is needed now just for daily life. So there's a real need, a real push to get new forms of power online here in Utah.
Yeah. And as I recall, way back when was, you know, the concern was the half-life of uranium, I mean, which is used, again, to fuel these reactors. I mean, when we talk about a half-life, we're talking about 700 million years.
Yeah,
and we're talking
a lot
that's
of time.
A half-life. It's not talking about the full life. So it's so interesting that, I don't know, if we figured out how to keep ourselves safe from what we do with the spent, you know, the spent fuel. So
yeah, hearing some lawmakers talk about this, apparently I haven't done much research into the exact technology on this, but there have been some strides on recycling some of this waste material and maybe repurposing it for another use. So I think, like we said, the technology has come quite a long way since these early power plants we saw in the 20th century. But the big question mark there is, a lot of that hasn't been developed in the United States, and it's largely unproven to work in the United States. So we'll see where that goes.
All right. House Bill 267, this is the push to bar public sector unions like teachers and firefighters from collective bargaining. It sounds like we've got a reprieve here.
It does. So right now, this bill is awaiting another vote in the Senate right now. So for people who haven't been following this bill, the original version, would have eliminated public sector unions from collectively bargaining. So that's things like your public school teachers, your firefighters, your police officers, some other municipal employees, garbage people, garbage men, garbage women, who may be part of a union. They would lose the ability to collective bargain with their employer, their school district, their municipality, their county government. But at the end of last week, we had Senate sponsor Senator Kirk Cullimore say there is a substitute that would allow a path for collective bargaining if I think it's a simple majority of employees in a workplace wanted. Basically, this would require a new union certification election every few years. And what we've heard from these public unions is they are this change, if it were to be adopted by the Senate, is they're neutral to it to mildly supportive. Obviously, it's another hurdle for them to go over, but they're not losing that tool in their tool belt of collective bargaining entirely. And talking with lawmakers about this, almost across the board, they say in all of their years working at the Capitol, of all the controversial issues they've taken up, this is the bill that they have heard the most from constituents about. So kind of telling when we talk about all the controversial things that have been taken up in the last couple of years, whether it's transgender rights, whether it's DEI initiatives, it's unionizing. It's the power of labor unions that really, really, really has motivated a lot of people to get up to Capitol Hill.
Okay. Stay tuned on that one. Senate Bill 120, this, my understanding, would sunset funding for a number of programs, including programs like dual immersion, something that I know Park City School District has supported, and well before they received any funding for it. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, so this one, I listened in to the recording of the committee hearing on this last week, and the Senate sponsor, Senator Lincoln Fillmore, his opening remarks, he's like, I understand that when people read the summary of this bill, it's going to scare them. They're going to think I'm going to be cutting all of their favorite programs. But the reasoning behind this is he said there's 37 programs in public schools that have a sunset review process. So there is a date set where this could expire, and then the legislature can renew it if they see it is it working properly, is adding good value to the education process. He said the bill, the programs that are listed in this, like the dual immersion you talked about, currently don't have sunset dates. And so he's saying he's not getting rid of them necessarily. He is adding in a sunset provision that would put these programs up for review every however many years they decide. So according to him, this one sounds a little scary, but in practice is less scary. Obviously, some of these programs are very popular, and I would assume that when they do come up for review, they will show value for certain students, and I think there will be an appetite to fund a lot of it. But like you said, this one on its surface definitely raised some eyebrows, but the technicalities of state law, sometimes the language is a little scary and the outcome is a little bit less so.
Okay. House Bill 1, this was a $60 million cut to Utah's higher education instruction budget. Only one representative, Kathleen Rigby, a teacher, voted against it. What does this mean for, say, University of Utah?
So this really speaks to a larger conversation we've been having about higher ed over the last couple of years. This is kind of the financial piece to it. Basically, $60 million to cut from state university funding. And basically, when you talk to Republicans in the House and Senate, they want to cut the cost of college overall and want to make higher ed more valuable to students. I'm thinking back to Speaker Mike Schultz during his opening remarks to the legislature on the first day of the session. He really said that some people simply take too long to get a degree and could make more money by not going the four-year college route. They may go into the trades instead, go to a technical college to learn something like welding. And I think he does have a strong argument there. I think a lot of people would maybe take the opposite side of that when they look at the value of a college degree, a four-year college degree. But I think when we look at the economic needs throughout the state, I think anyone who has tried to do any, excuse me, any construction or any renovations to their homes knows that there is a shortage of well-trained, skilled tradespeople in the state of Utah, whether it's plumbers, carpenters, electricians. Those are hard to come by, and there's a huge demand for that. And a lot of those trades, if you go into that as a career, you could be making more money than if you went to a traditional four-year college and went into an office job. So I think there is some good intent behind it, but I think a lot of people see this and they're like, this is a continuation of this DEI argument we had the other year, where they want to get rid of the fluffy degrees, the art history, more progressive, traditionally or stereotypically progressive aimed degrees at these colleges, and want it to be purely focused on economic impact one after graduation.
Yeah, but this feels like Big Brother. And again, it's their life. They can be whomever they want. I mean, it's like, it's not all about money, and at the risk of, do we lose our poets, our performers, and our philosophers?
I think that's the argument a lot of people are going to make. Like, what is the value, like, really, truly, what is the cultural value of a lot of this as well, not just economic value? Obviously, this budget process takes the entire session to come to fruition, and I think we'll be having discussions about this. Legislators certainly will be having discussions about this up until the last day when the state budget is finally voted on. So I think... If this is something you feel very strongly about, if anyone listening is feeling very strongly about this, contact your representative. Let them know what you think the value of higher ed should be in the state of Utah. And if you're someone who wants to foster the next great novelist or the next great symphony performer here in Utah, let them know that's what you want.
Okay. Moving on to Senate Bill 73, basically requiring all initiative backers to publish text in newspapers for 60 days before going on the ballot. I read this would be at a cost of about $1.4 million. So is this essentially the end of seeing any more statewide initiatives?
The people who are big fans of statewide initiatives certainly are raising the alarms about this bill and also a companion called Senate Joint Resolution 2, which would do something a little bit different. I'll explain later. But SB 73, this is another bill by Senator Lincoln Fillmore. Like you said, it would require initiatives to be published in statewide newspapers 60 days before an election. That's the estimation that it would add another $1.4 million to this process, which is already quite onerous. You have to get a ballot initiative on the ballot in the state of Utah, you need to collect enough signatures that equal 8% of the total voters in the state of Utah. That's quite a big number. You need to collect signatures from, I think it's 25 or 26 Senate districts throughout the state, and then hold 7 or 8 public hearings to talk about your bill in all corners of the state. So it's not an easy process to get it on the ballot, and adding a price tag of at least $1.4 million to it, it certainly would make it a little bit harder. And the other piece to this is this Senate Joint Resolution, which would be a constitutional amendment that would raise the barrier to pass an initiative to 60% if the initiative would raise taxes or change revenue in any way. So for people thinking back to last year with the Amendment A and the Amendment D fiasco, since those two things that we were supposed to be voting on did not change taxes, that would still be a 50% threshold. But thinking back to 2018, if anyone remembers the talk about medical marijuana, Medicaid expansion, those did have a financial element to it. Something like that would be raised to 60% to pass. So they're certainly aiming at making this process even harder than it already is.
Yeah. And again, as we saw with the medical marijuana and Prop 4, where we saw the initiative to have an independent redistricting commission, legislature did what they wanted anyway with those two. So let's see. Finally, I've got to ask, every year we see it, this year it's House Bill 120, the Daylight Saving Bill. I don't know, where do things stand here? And again, I don't know that it's one, whether we stay on standard time or daylight saving time, but I think it's the concern is let's just stop changing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who get a little frustrated every time the clocks change twice a year. Where this one stands right now, it's currently circled in the House, so it's on hold. We might see an amendment or another substitute to go on to this. And like you said, this discussion happens all the time. It's been going on for decades. There's a lot of arguments for or against daylight savings time. I know there are certain economic benefits that people say that daylight savings time speaks to. Some studies suggested that daylight savings time can stimulate the economy. Longer daylight hours means more people are outside of their houses. Maybe they're shopping, participating in leisure activities, spending money basically is what people do when it's light out. There's also an energy saving a component to daylight savings as well. If it's later, it's later in the day, people are using less artificial light, using less energy. And there's also arguments to the contrary of that as well. So I think this one It's a good one to just kind of get people riled up, whether it goes anywhere. The fact that it's circled in the House right now after passing unanimously out of committee kind of tells me there's not much of an appetite to maybe move this forward, at least quickly. So we'll see where this one goes.
Okay, Sean, as always, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's KUER legislative reporter Sean Higgins. Studio with an update now from the Summit Land Conservancy. I'm CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
Park City Council will be reviewing the final Treasure Hill conservation easement on Thursday. So this is done deal?
Well, it's not a done deal until they vote for it. So, but we do think that we have a good easement document, and it would be really great to be able to sit here with you and look out at Treasure Hill behind your shoulder and know that that land actually is protected forever.
Yeah, we've talked about why this has taken so long. There's just a lot of easements, undocumented easements, and how long does it usually take to get a conservation easement done? Because this, we're going on what? Six years?
Yes. When the city purchased the land, which the purchase was final in 2019, there was a clause in the purchase agreement that said you had to wait 2 years before placing the conservation easement on the property because the city and the seller, everybody wanted to make sure that all of the easements were cleared up, all of the lot lines were cleared. So there was a very comprehensive survey, a very comprehensive title report, just to make sure that, I mean, you know, there's lots of neighbors here. There's the ski lease that goes over the top with Vail Resorts. So there's a lot of complications on this project. And then, of course, COVID hit, so things really got slowed down. We're really excited, though, to really finally be moving forward on this.
So what if a future council decided it needed some of this land for a pressing need? I mean, are there any reasons that any development would be allowed here?
It's hard to see that any development would be allowed on the property because the conservation easement is meant to preserve the values that, you know, the reason we all paid an awful lot of money for this property, which was the open space, the access to public trails, the wildlife habitat. You know, we all know about the moose that love Sweeney switchbacks as much as we do. So those are the conservation values that need to be protected. You know, if somebody, if conservation easements can, in very rare cases, be condemned, but there has to be a higher public benefit than what's already there. So it puts a really high bar on how to, you know, on things that could possibly change and damage the conservation values that are there today.
Okay. Summit Land Conservancy will be in Wasatch County as a sponsor for ski touring on February 14th and 15th. Right now, I think we have a mud pit, not a ski track. So we're just kind of holding out to see what happens.
You know, hopefully the snow that's predicted for later on this week actually is snow. So, yes.
So is this a fundraiser?
It's not at all. No, we are actually a sponsor of Ski Joring. You know, we really appreciate what's going on in Wasatch County. You know, they passed a bond in 2018, and Midway also passed a bond in 2018, and then Midway passed a new bond just last year in 2024. So the community in Wasatch County is really looking to preserve open space. You know, we heard Wasatch County Manager Justin Graybow on the radio here with you just earlier today talking about how that funding, the bond funding, has really been leveraged many, many times over. And, you know, that's what Summit Land Conservancy does as your land trust is, you know, we go in and we put together all the different partners, whether that's the federal funding, the county funding, private funding, so that the bond money really does get leveraged over and over again. So we just wanted to let people know that the Summit Land Conservancy is available. We, even though Summit is in our name, we work all across the Wasatch Back. We like to say we work in the high country of Utah.
Yeah, so tickets still available?
I believe so. UtahSkiJoring.com.
Okay. And again, if the weather doesn't cooperate, what, any plans?
You know, you'd have to check on that website to see what it says. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope it happens.
As you mentioned, the Wasatch County Council tomorrow will be looking at a couple of open space bond purchases. Are you involved in either of those two?
No, those are both with another organization, with Utah Open Lands, yeah.
Okay. And I guess with the change in administration now on a national level, what's your outlook for federal open space dollars going forward?
There is always concern every time there's a change in administration because, you know, the incoming administration wants to make sure that their priorities are top of mind. We have been fortunate because the federal funding source that the Summit Land Conservancy uses, which is the Natural Resources Conservation Service, it's a farm bill program. It's called the Conservation Title. And so it's really set out to save farm and ranch land. And that has enjoyed bipartisan support for many, many years. So, you know, the farm bill will have two sponsors, a Republican and a Democrat. And our programs generally are not the controversial part of the farm bill. Things like food stamps, which is also part of the farm bill, those are the things that tend to be a little more controversial. What we are looking closely at, however, is the Inflation Reduction Act, which also passed with bipartisan support in 2022, put a lot of additional money, like billions of dollars, into those conservation programs that we all use. And the question is whether or not that additional funding will stay in the farm bill. The Congress needs to approve a new farm bill this year, so we are actually talking quite a bit to our elected Utah representatives to make sure that they understand how important this is to Utah families and Utah communities.
All right, coming up this Friday, you've got a moonshine adventure. What's happening here?
That's right. So with our friends at Mountain Trails Foundation, we're meeting out in Round Valley to howl at the moon. And so we do encourage people to visit our website, wesaveland.org, and click on the happenings tab, because we do need to know how much food to bring.
So is there a fee?
No.
No. Okay.
No. Nope.
What time do you need?
7 p.m. is usually the time.
All right. And hopefully some snow coming down, because we heard it was pretty icy out there today.
Yeah, I can get, gets a little, yeah.
And then just finally, a real quick message about dogs.
That's right. Yeah, we've been hearing about dogs harassing wildlife out in Round Valley. And, you know, this year we've seen a lot of wildlife in the Round Valley area. So, you know, there's not only the elk and the moose, but also coyotes. And so we really do encourage people to remember that while it is an off-leash area, when Round Valley was created as an off-leash area, the caveat was you still have to have your dog under control. So if your dog is running rampant and chasing and you can't call your dog off, that's not under control. And we really hope that people will respect this part of the rule, because if there are, you know, most people do, most people are fabulous, most people pick up other people's poop, it's great. But a few bad actors out there can really cause trouble for not just the wildlife, but everybody else. So please make sure that you have a leash with you when you're out in Round Valley, so that when you see that moose or those elk or the coyotes, you can, you know, get your pet under control for everybody's safety.
Okay, Cheryl, thanks.
Thank you.
Cheryl Fox is the CEO of Summit Land Conservancy.